Chapter 3. Horus enthroned. The saint is in danger. Istvan 3. Lupercal's court was a new addition to the vengeful spirit. Previously, the War Master had held briefings and planning sessions on the Strategium, but it had been decided that he needed somewhere grander to hold court. Designed by Peter Egon Momus, it had been artfully constructed to place the War Master in a setting more suited to his position as the leader of the Great Crusade, and present him as the first among equals to his fellow commanders. Vast banners hung from the sides of the room, most belonging to the Legion's battle companies, though there were a few that Loken didn't recognize. He saw one with a throne of skulls, set against a tower of brass rising from a blood-red sea, and another with an eight-pointed black star shining in a white sky. The meaning of such obscure symbols confounded Loken, but he assumed that they represented the warrior lodge that had become integral to the Legion. Greater than all the majesty designed by the architect designate was the Primarch of the Sons of Horus himself, enthroned before them on a great basalt throne. Abaddon and Aximand stood to one side. Both warriors were armoured, Abaddon in the glossy black of the Justeran, Aximand in his pale green plate. The two officers glared at Loken and Torgadon, the enmity that had grown between them during the Aurician campaign too great to hide any more. As he met Abaddon's flinty gaze, Loken felt great sadness as he realized that the glorious ideal of the Mournival was finally and irrevocably dead. None of them spoke as Loken and Torgadon took their places on the other side of the War Master. Loken had stood with these warriors and sworn an oath by the light of a reflected moon on a planet the inhabitants called Terra to counsel the War Master and preserve the soul of the Legion. That felt like a very long time ago.
Loken. Torgadon, said Horus,
and even after all that had happened, Loken felt honored to be so addressed.
Your role here is simply to observe and remind our Legion brothers of the solidity of our cause. Do you understand?
Yes, my War Master, said Torgadon.
Loken,
asked the War Master. Loken nodded and took his allotted position.
Yes, War Master.
He felt the War Master's penetrating eyes boring into him, but kept his gaze fixed firmly on the arches that led into the Lupercal's court, as the doors beneath one of them slid open. The tramp of feet sounded, and a blood-red angel of death emerged from the shadows. Loken had seen the Primarch of the World-Eaters before, but was still awed by his monstrous physical presence. Angron was huge, easily as tall as the War Master, but also massively broad, with wide, hulking shoulders like some enormous beast of burden. His face was scarred and violent, his eyes buried deep in folds of angry red scar tissue. Ugly cortical implants jutted from his scalp, connected to the collar of his armor by ribbed cables. The Primarch's armor was ancient and bronze, like that of a feral world god, with heavy metal plates over mail and twin chain axes strapped to his back. Loken had heard that Angron had once been a slave before the Emperor had found him, and that his masters had forced the implants on him to turn him into a psychotic killer for their fighting pits. Looking at Angron, Loken could well believe it. Angron's equerry, Khan, flanked the terrifying Primarch, his expression neutral, where his master's was thunder.
Horus,
said Angron, his voice rough and brutal.
I see the War Master welcomes his brother like a king. Am I your subject now?
Angron, replied Horus, unperturbed, it is good that you could join us.
And miss all this prettiness? Not for the world,
said Angron, his voice loaded with the threat of a smoldering volcano. A second delegation arrived through another of the arches, arrayed in the purple and gold of the Emperor's children. Led by Eidolon in all his magnificence, a squad of Astartes with glittering swords marched alongside the Lord Commander, their battle gear as ornate as their leaders.
War Master, the Lord Fulgrim sends his regards,
stated Eidolon formally and with great humility. Loken saw that Eidolon had learned the ways of a practiced diplomat since he had last spoken to the War Master.
He assures you that his task is well underway, and that he will join us soon. I speak for him, and command the Legion in his stead.
Loken's eyes darted from Angron to Eidolon, seeing the obvious antipathy between the two legions. The Emperor's children and the World-Eaters were as different as could be. Angron's legion fought and won through raw aggression, while the Emperor's children had perfected the art of picking an enemy force apart and destroying it a piece at a time.
"Lord Angron," said Eidolon with a bow, "it is an honour."
Angron did not deign to reply, and Loken saw Eidolon stiffen at this insult. But any immediate confrontation was averted as the final delegation to the Warmaster entered the Lupercal's court. Mortarion, Primarch of the Death Guard, was backed by a unit of warriors armoured in the dull gleam of unpainted Terminator plate. Mortarion's armour was also bare, with a brass skull of the Death Guard on one shoulder guard. His pallid face and scalp were hairless and pocked, his mouth and throat hidden by a heavy collar that hissed spurts of grey steam as he breathed. A Death Guard captain marched beside the Primarch, and Loken recognized him with a smile. Captain Nathaniel Garrow had fought alongside the Sons of Horus in the days when they had been known as the Lunar Wolves. The Terran-born captain had won many friends within the Warmaster's Legion for his unshakable code of honour and his straightforward, honest manner. The Death Guard warrior caught Loken's gaze and gave a perfunctory nod of greeting.
"With our brother Mortarion," said Horus, "we are complete."
The Warmaster stood and descended from the elevated throne to the centre of the court as the lights dimmed and a glowing globe appeared above him, hovering just below the ceiling.
"This," said Horus, "is Istvan III, courtesy of servitor-manned stellar cartography drones. Remember it well, for history will be made here."
Jonah Arukan paused in his labours and slipped a small hip flask from beneath his uniform jacket as he checked for anyone watching. The hangar bay was bustling with activity, as it always seemed to be these days, but no one was paying him any attention. The days when an Imperator Titan being made ready for war would pause even the most jaded warmaker in his tracks were long past, for there were few here who had not seen the mighty form of the Dies Irae being furnished for battle scores of times already. He took a hit from the flask and looked up at the old girl. The Titan's hull was scored and dented with wounds the Mechanicum servitors had not yet had time to patch, and Jonah patted the thick plates of her leg armour affectionately.
"Well, old girl," he said, "you've certainly seen some action, but I still love you."
He smiled at the thought of a man being in love with a machine, but he'd love anything that had saved his life as often as the Dies Irae had. Through the fires of uncounted battles, they had fought together, and as much as Titus Kassar denied it, Jonah knew that there was a mighty heart and soul at the core of this glorious war machine. Jonah took another drink from his flask as his expression turned sour, thinking of Titus and his damned sermons. Titus said he felt the light of the Emperor within him, but Jonah didn't feel much of anything anymore. As much as he wanted to believe in what Titus was preaching, he just couldn't let go of the skeptical core at the center of his being. To believe in things that weren't there, that couldn't be seen or felt. Titus called it faith, but Jonah was a man who needed to believe in what was real, what could be touched and experienced. Princeps Ternit would discharge him from the crew of the Dies Irae if he knew he had attended prayer meetings back on Darvin, and the thought of spending the rest of the crusade as a menial denied forever the thrill of commanding the finest war machine ever to come from the forges of Mars sent a cold shiver down his spine. Every few days, Titus would ask him to come to another prayer meeting, and the times he said yes, they would furtively make their way to some forsaken part of the ship to listen to passages read from the Lectitio Divinitatis. Each time he would sweat the journey back for fear of discovery and the court-martial that would no doubt follow. Jonah had been a career Titan crewman since the day he had first set foot aboard his inaugural posting, a warhound Titan called the Venator, and he knew that if it came down to a choice, he would choose the Dies Irae over the Lectitio Divinitatis every time. But still, the thought that Titus might be right continued to nag at him. He leaned back against the Titan's leg, sliding down until he was sitting on his haunches with his knees drawn up to his chest.
Faith, he whispered. You can't earn it, and you can't buy it. Where, then, do I find it?
Well, said a voice behind and above him, you can start by putting that flask away and coming with me. Jonah looked up and saw Titus Kassar, resplendent as always in his parade-ready uniform, standing in the arched entrance to the Titan's leg bastions.
Titus, said Jonah, hurriedly stuffing the hip flask back into his jacket. What's up?
We have to go, said Titus urgently. The Saint is in danger.
Maggard stalked along the shadowed companionways with the vengeful spirit at a brisk pace, marching at double time with the vigour of a man on his way to a welcome rendezvous. His hulking form had been steadily growing over the last few months, as though he was afflicted with some hideous form of rapid gigantism. But the procedures the War Master's apothecaries were performing on his frame were anything but hideous. His body was changing, growing and transforming beyond anything the crude surgeries of House Carpenters had ever managed. Already he could feel the new organs within him reshaping his flesh and bone into something greater than he could ever have imagined, and this was just the beginning. His curlian blade was unsheathed, shimmering with a strange glow in the dim light of the corridor. He wore fresh white robes, his enlarging physique already too massive for his armour. Legion artificers stood ready to reshape it once his flesh had settled into its new form, and he missed its reassuring solidity enclosing him. Like him, his armour would be born anew, forged into something worthy of the War Master and his chosen warriors. Maggard knew he was not yet ready for such inclusion, but he had already carved himself a niche within the Sons of Horus. He walked where the Astartes could not, acted where they could not be seen to act, and spilled blood where they needed to be seen as peacemakers. It required a special kind of man to do such work, efficiently and conscience-free, and Maggard was perfectly suited to his new role. He had killed hundreds of people at the behest of House Carpenters, and many more than that before he had been captured by them, but these had been poor, messy killings compared to the death he now carried. He remembered the sense of magnificent beginnings when Malachurst had tasked him with the death of Ignace Carcassi. Maggard had jammed the barrel of his pistol beneath the poet's quivering jaw and blown his brains out over the roof of his cramped room before letting the generously fleshed body crash to the floor in a flurry of bloody papers. Why Malachurst had required Carcassi's death did not concern Maggard. The equerry spoke with the voice of Horus, and Maggard had pledged his undying loyalty to the War Master on the battlefield of Darvin when he had offered him his sword. Later, whether in reward or as part of his ongoing designs, the War Master had killed his former mistress, Petronella Vivar, and for that Maggard was forever in his debt. Whatever the War Master desired, Maggard would move heaven or hell to see it done. Now, he had been ordered to do something wondrous. Now he was going to kill a saint. Cinderman beat his middle finger against his chin in a nervous tattoo as he tried to look as if he belonged in this part of the ship. Deck crew in orange jumpsuits and ordnance officers in yellow jackets threaded past him as he awaited his accomplices in this endeavour. He clutched the chit the guard had given him tightly, as though it were some kind of talisman that would protect him if someone challenged him.
"Come on, come on," he whispered. "Where are you?"
It had been a risk contacting Titus Kassar, but he had no one else to turn to. Mercedes did not believe in the Lectitia Divinitatis, and in truth he wasn't sure he did yet, but he knew that whatever or whoever had sent in the vision of Euphrates Keeler had meant him to act upon it. Likewise, Garvil Locum was out of the question, for it was certain that his movements would not escape notice.
"Iterator,"
hissed a voice from beside him, and Cinderman almost cried aloud in surprise. Titus Kassar stood beside him, an earnest expression creasing his slender face. Another man stood behind him, similarly uniformed in the dark blue of a Titan crewman.
"Titus," breathed Cinderman in relief. "I wasn't sure you'd be able to come. We won't have long before Princeps Turnit notices we are not at our posts, but your communication said the Saint was in danger."
"She is," confirmed Cinderman.
"Grave danger."
How do you know?
Asked the second man. Kassar's brow twisted in annoyance.
I'm sorry, Kirill. This is Jonah Arukin, my fellow moderati on the Dies Irae. He is one of us.
I just know, said Cinnamon. I saw. I don't know. A vision of her lying on her bed, and I just knew that someone intended her harm.
A vision,
breathed Kassar.
Truly you are one of the chosen of the Emperor.
No, no, hissed Cinnamon. I'm really not. Now, come on. We don't have time for this. We have to go now.
Where?
Asked Jonah Arukin.
The Medicaid deck,
said Cinnamon, holding up his chit.
We have to get to the Medicaid deck.
The surface of the shimmering globe above Horus resolved into continents and oceans, overlaid with the traceries of geophysical features, plains, forests, seas, mountain ranges and cities. Horus held up his arms, as if supporting the globe from below, like some titan from the ancient myths of old Earth.
This is Istvan III, he repeated. A world brought into compliance 13 years ago by the 27th Expeditionary Force of our brother Korax.
And he wasn't up to the job, snorted Angron.
Horus shot Angron a dangerous look.
There was some resistance, yes. But the last elements of the aggressive faction were destroyed by the Raven Guard at the Red Arth Valley.
The battle site flared red on the globe, nestled among a mountain range on one of Istvan III's northern continents.
The Remembrancer Order was not yet foisted upon us by the Council of Terror, but a substantial civilian contingent was left behind to begin integration with the Imperial Truth.
Are we to assume that the Truth didn't take? Asked Eidolon.
Mortarian?
Prompted Horus, gesturing to his brother Primarch.
4 months ago, the Death Guard received a distress signal from Istvan III,
said Mortarian.
It was weak and old. We only received it because one of our supply ships joining the fleet at Arcturan dropped out of the warp for repairs. Given the age of the signal and the time it took for it to be relayed to my command, it is likely that it was sent at least 2 years ago. What did it say?
Asked Angron. In reply, the holographic image of the globe unfolded into a large flat plane, like a pict screen hovering in the air, black, with just a hint of shadowy movement. A shape moved on the screen, and Loken realized it was a face, a woman's face, orange lit by a candle flame that provided the only light. She appeared to be in a small, stone-walled chamber. Even over the poor quality of the signal, Loken could tell that the woman was terrified, her eyes wide and her breathing rapid and shallow. She gleamed with sweat.
The insignia on her collar, said Torgadon, is from the 27th expedition.
The woman adjusted the device she was using to record the image, and sound flooded into the Lupercal's court, crackling flames, distant yelling and gunfire.
It's revolution, said the woman, her voice warped by static. Open revolt. These people, they've rejected it all. We tried to integrate them. We thought the war singers were just some primitive superstition, but it was much more. It was real. Prowl has gone mad, and the war singers are with him.
The woman suddenly looked around at something off-screen.
No!
She screamed desperately, and opened fire with a weapon previously held out of view. Violent muzzle flashes lit her, and something indescribable flailed against the far wall as she emptied her weapon into it.
They're closer. They know we're here, and I think I'm the last one.
The woman turned back to the screen.
It's madness. Complete madness down here. Please. I don't think I'm going to get through this. Send someone, anyone, just make this stop.
A hideous, atonal keening sound blared from the pict screen. The woman grabbed her head, her screams drowned by the inhuman sound. The last frames jerked and fragmented, freeze-framing through a series of gruesome images. Blood in the woman's frenzied eye, a swirling mass of flesh and shattered stone, and a mouth locked open, blood on teeth. Then blackness.
There have been no further communications from Istvan III,
concluded Mortarion, filling the silence that followed.
The planet's astropaths have either been compromised or they are dead.
The name Prahl refers to Vardis Prahl, said Horus.
The governor left behind to command Istvan III in the name of the Imperium, ensure compliance, and manage the dismantling of the traditional religious structures that define the planet's autochthonous society. If he is complicit in the rebellion on Istvan III, as this recording suggests, then he is one of our objectives.
Loken felt a shiver travel down his spine at the thought of once again facing a population whose imperial official had turned traitor. He glanced over at Torgadon and saw that the similarities with the Darwin campaign were not lost on his comrade. The hollow swelled and returned to the image of Istvan III.
The cultural and religious capital of Istvan is here, said Horus, as the image zoomed in on one of the northern cities, which commanded a large hinterland at the foot of a colossal range of mountains. The Coral City. This is the source of the distress signal and the seat of Prahl's command, a building known as the Precentor's Palace. Multiple spear tips will seize a number of strategic objectives, and with the city in our hands, Istvan will be ours. The first assault will be a combined force made up of Astartes from all legions, with backup from the Titans of the Mechanicum and the Imperial Army. The rest of the planet will then be subjugated by whichever Imperial Army reinforcements can reach us with the warp in its current state.
Why not just bombard them? Asked Eidolon.
The sudden silence that followed his question was deafening. Loken waited for the Warmaster to reprimand Eidolon for daring to question one of his decisions, but Horus only nodded indulgently.
Because these people are vermin. And when you stamp out vermin from afar, some invariably survive. If we are to cut out the problem, we must get our hands dirty and destroy them in one fell swoop. It may not be as elegant as the Emperor's children would wish, but elegance is not a priority for me. Only swift victory.
Of course, said Eidolon, shaking his head. To think that these fools should be so blind to the realities of the galaxy.
Have no fear, Lord Commander,
said Abaddon, descending to stand beside the Warmaster.
They will be illuminated as to the error of their ways.
Loken risked a sidelong glance at the first captain, surprised at the respect he heard in his voice. All the previous dealings between the sons of Horus and Eidolon had led him to believe that Abaddon held the arrogant Lord Commander in contempt. What had changed?
Mortarion, continued Horus, your objective will be to engage the main force of the Coral City's army. If they are anything like they were when the Raven Guard fought them, they will be professional soldiers and will not break easily, even when confronted with Astartes.
The hollow zoomed in to show a map of the Coral City, a handsome conurbation with many and varied buildings that ranged from exquisite mansions and basilica to massive sprawls of housing and tangles of industrial complexes. Artfully formed boulevards and thoroughfares threaded a multi-leveled city of millions, most of whom appeared to be housed in sprawling residential districts, workshops, and factories. The western edge of the city was highlighted, focusing on the scar-like web of defensive trenches and bunkers along the city's outskirts. The opposite side of the Coral City butted up against the sheer cliffs of a mountain range, the natural defenses efficiently shielding the city from a conventional land attack. Unfortunately for the Coral City, the Warmaster clearly wasn't planning a conventional land attack.
It appears that a sizable armed force is manning these defenses, said Horus. It looks as if they have excellent fortifications and artillery. Many of these defenses were added after compliance to protect the seat of Imperial governance on Istvan, which means they're ours, and they will be strong. It will be ugly work engaging and destroying this force, and there is still much about the Coral City's military we do not know.
I welcome this challenge, Warmaster, said Mortarion. This is my legion's natural battlefield.
Another location lurched into focus, a spectacular conglomeration of arches and spires, with dozens of labyrinth-like wings and additions, surrounding a magnificent central dome faced in polished stone. The city's crowning glory, the structure looked like a jeweled brooch set in the twisted mass of the Coral City.
"The Precentor's Palace," said Eidolon, appreciatively.
"And your legion will take it," said Horus, "along with the World Eaters."
Again, Loken caught Eidolon's glance at Angron, the Lord Commander unable to conceal the distaste he felt at the thought of fighting alongside such a barbaric legion. If Angron was aware of Eidolon's scornful glance, he gave no sign of it.
"The palace is one of Pral's most likely locations," said Horus. "Therefore, the palace is one of our most important objectives. The palace must be taken, the Coral City's leadership destroyed, and Pral killed. He is a traitor, so I do not expect or wish him to be taken alive."
Finally, the Hollow zoomed in on a curious mass of stonework some way east of the Precentor's Palace. To Loken's untutored eye, it looked like a collection of church spires or temples, sacred buildings heaped one on top of one another over the centuries.
"This is the Siren Hold, and my sons of Horus will lead the attack on it," said Horus. "Coral City's revolt appears to be religious in nature, and the Siren Hold was the spiritual heart of the city. According to Korax's reports, this was the seat of the old pagan religion that was supposed to have been dismantled. It is presumed that it still exists, and that the leadership of that religion will be found here. This is another likely location for Vardis Pral, so again, I do not require prisoners, only destruction."
For the first time, Loken saw the battlefield he would soon be fighting on. The Siren Hold looked like difficult ground to take. Massive, complicated structures creating a confusing multi-leveled warren with plenty of places to hide. Dangerous ground. That was why the War Master had sent his own legion to take it. He knew they could do it. The Hollow zoomed out again to a view of the planet itself.
"Preliminary operations will involve the destruction of the monitoring stations on the seventh planet of Istvan Extremis," said Horus. "When the rebels are blind, the invasion of Istvan III will commence. The units chosen to lead the first wave will deploy by drop pod and gunship, with a second wave ready in reserve. I trust you all understand what is required of your legions."
"I have only one question, War Master," said Angron.
"Speak,"
said Horus.
"Why do we plan this attack with such precision, when a single massive strike will do the job just as well?"
"You object to my plans, Angron?"
Horus asked carefully.
"Of course I object," spat Angron. "We have four legions, titans and starships at our disposal, and this is just one city. We should hit it with everything we have and slaughter them in the streets. Then we will see how many on this planet have the stomach to rebel. But no, you would have us kill them one by one and pick off their leaders as if we are here to preserve this world. Rebellion is in the people, Horus. Kill the people and the rebellion ends."
"Lord Angron," said Eidolon, reasonably, "you speak out of turn."
"Hold your tongue in the presence of your betters," snarled Angron. "I know what you Emperor's children think of us, but you mistake our directness for stupidity. Speak to me again without my consent, and I will kill you. Angron!"
Horus's voice cut through the building tension, and the Primarch of the World-Eaters turned his murderous attention away from Eidolon.
"You place little value on the lives of your World-Eaters," said Horus, "and you believe in the way of war you have made your own, but that does not place you beyond my authority. I am the War Master, the commander of everyone and everything that falls under the aegis of the Great Crusade. Your legion will deploy according to the orders I have given you. Is that clear?"
Angron nodded curtly as Horus turned to Eidolon.
"Lord Commander Eidolon, you are not among equals here, and your presence in this war council is dependent upon my good graces, which will be rapidly worn thin should you conduct yourself as if Fulgrim was here to nursemaid you."
Eidolon rapidly recovered his composure.
"Of course, my War Master. I meant no disrespect. I shall ensure that my legion is prepared for the assault on Istvan Extremis and the capture of the Precentor's Palace."
Horus switched his gaze to Angron, who grunted in assent.
"The World-Eaters will be ready, War Master," said Karn.
"Then this conclave is at an end," said Horus.
"Return to your legions and make ready for war."
The delegations filed out, Khan speaking quietly with Angron, and Eidolon adopting a swagger, as if to compensate for his dressing down. Loken thought he saw a gleam of amusement in Mortarian's eyes as he left with Garrow and his Terminators in tow. Horus turned to Abaddon and said, "Have a Stormbird prepared to convey me to the Conqueror. Angron must be illuminated as to the proper conduct of this endeavour." Horus turned and made his way from the Lupercal's court, with Abaddon and Aximand following behind him, without so much as a backward glance at Loken and Torgadon.
"That was educational," said Torgadon, when they were alone.
Loken smiled wearily.
"I could feel you willing Angron to strike Eidolon."
Torgadon laughed, remembering when he and Eidolon had almost come to blows when they had first met on the surface of murder.
"If only we could join the Warmaster and the Conqueror," said Torgadon. "Now that would be something worth seeing. Horus illuminating Angron. What would they talk about?"
"What indeed?" agreed Loken.
There was so much Loken didn't know, but as he pondered his unhappy ignorance, he remembered the last thing Kirill Sinderman had shouted to him, as he was led away by Malachurst's soldiers.
"Tarek, we have a battle to prepare for, so I want you to get everyone ready. There's going to be a hard fight on Istvan III."
"I know," said Torgadon. "The Siren Hold. What a bloody shambles. This is what happens when you give people a god to believe in. Get Vipers up to speed as well. If we're attacking the Siren Hold, I want Lacasta with us."
"Of course," nodded Torgadon. "Sometimes I think you and Nero are the only people I can trust anymore. What are you going to be doing?"
"I have some reading to catch up on," said Loken.